I ended the last lecture with an ecstatic account of the marital happiness of Othello and Desdemona as they arrived on the island of Cyprus. There is one detail to be added to that account. During that full-throated epithalamion, Iago is standing always on the side of the stage. And at the end of it, he says quietly, "Oh, you are well-tuned now, but I'll set down the pegs that tune that music." Iago proposes to destroy their happiness, to destroy the music, which is always a symbol of harmony in Shakespeare, to produce discords on the pegs. Why? Iago is one of the big problems in Shakespearean criticism. There has been much throwing about of brains as to why Iago chooses to destroy Othello, Desdemona, Cassio, Rodrigo, the rest of them. Why does he do the terrible things he does? He does acknowledge some motives. He soliloquizes to us frequently and mentions some 5 or 6 reasons why he should be doing this. First, that Othello has deprived him of a post that he felt he deserved. He should have promoted Iago to be his lieutenant. Instead, he passed Iago over and appointed Michael Cassio. That sounds quite legitimate when first we are introduced to the motive. The trouble is, he forgets that after a while, and we begin to get other motives. That, for example, Othello has cuckolded Iago, slept with his wife, Amelia. Then he mentions later on that he fears Cassio with his nightcap too, that Cassio may have cuckolded him with Amelia. There's one passage in which he seems to admit a desire for Desdemona himself. That's not quite clear. That's why I had to say 5 or 6 motives. It certainly is the motive for Iago in the source story, the Italian tale by Cinzio that Shakespeare was adapting. But it's not quite clear that it carries over. He does admit that there is a daily beauty in Cassio's life that makes him feel ugly. And finally, he says that he wants to plume up his will in double knavery. To plume up my will in double knavery, whatever that means. Just to enjoy being wicked. The difficulty with this is, of course, there are too many motives, and none of them are dwelt upon with the kind of insistence that would really make them convincing. When a man in Shakespeare is jealous of his wife, we hear about it at great length, not just a passing, "I fear Cassio with my nightcap." When a man is ambitious, when a man is disappointed, Shakespeare writes long speeches about these things. These motives are tossed off and left to dangle as they may. At the end of the play, Shakespeare apparently refuses to explain Iago altogether. All the characters on stage want to know why Iago has done what he's done, once it is revealed in the final scene what he has done. And in particular, Othello says, "Demand that demi-devil why he hath thus ensnared my soul and body." And Iago replies, "Demand me nothing. What you know, you know. From this time forth, I never will speak word." And indeed, he never does. He has no further lines in the play. Iago declines to explain himself to others. He declines to open his motives to them or to us. Well, perhaps there's a clue in one word that Othello just used. Demand that demi-devil. Why? Is Iago a demi-devil? It has been argued with some frequency that Iago embodies an abstract form of evil that is derived from the older allegorical drama of the Middle Ages. The primary statement of this lies in a book called Shakespeare and the Allegory of Evil, written by a distinguished scholar called Bernard Spivak. He argues that the figure of Iago is based on the medieval character of the vice. The medieval drama put in the center of the stage an everyman figure, a mankind figure, a representative of us all, and put on opposite sides of him virtues showing him the steep and thorny path to heaven and vices inviting him down the primrose path of dalliance to hell. And the vice figure was the most popular character in the English medieval drama, the one whom the audience most loved. The vice, with a capital V, posed as being a friend of his victim, devoted to the welfare of mankind. He also gloried in his deceit. He practiced seduction as a sport. He developed a special relationship with the audience because he did a lot of soliloquizing. Look how I'm going to seduce this foolish young man into sinfulness. He was, in fact, a stage manager of the action put on stage to control it. And in this medieval drama, vice seduces every man without any real personal motive for it, simply in fulfillment of his nature as a vice. The vice is a tempter, simply as it is the function of the Statue of Liberty to hold up the torch of freedom. An allegorical person. In this view, in Spivak's argument, the core of Iago is this old medieval tempter. And the few human motives that are mentioned by Iago in the course of Othello are just put on to put a few scraps of clothing onto the bare allegorical bones. Now, this is a good argument. There is much reason to associate Iago with such a figure. Iago frequently invokes hell during the course of Shakespeare's play. At the end of Act One, he begins to have an idea of what scheme he will practice on Othello, and he says in soliloquy, "I have it, 'tis engendered. Hell and night must bring this monstrous birth to the world's light." And at the end of Act Two, when he has developed the plan further, he has a soliloquy beginning, "Divinity of hell, theology of hell. I am working out the arguments of hell. When devils will the blackest sins put on, they do suggest at first with heavenly shows as I do now. I am behaving like a devil." The imagery of hells and devils frequently surround Iago. Long before Othello calls him a demi-devil at the end of the play. It climaxes at the end of the play with that demi-devil line and one other very revealing line of Othello's. "I look down at his feet, but that's a fable." He's looking down at Iago's feet, expecting to see a cloven hoof, expecting to see the devil's foot. Now, there is a great deal to all this. The scholars who have explored the medieval background of Shakespearean drama have performed a valuable service in explaining the ancestry of Shakespeare's practices, explaining the concepts and patterns which the drama had been previously using and which were therefore readily available to Shakespeare and his fellow playwrights, readily comprehensible to his audience. Any playwright in any period needs such a collection of concepts or forms to dramatize his stories with. That doesn't mean he needs to stick to them. It doesn't mean he can only deploy the same old stereotypes. But to achieve communication, you need to have some common ground. A playwright needs both originality and old stuff. He needs stereotypes before he can start remolding them into something that's appropriate to his particular purpose at the moment that he's writing this play. So I think this is relevant. Let me pause here and go on to a different kind of explanation. On the other hand, we need not run full tilt into the medieval past to explain Iago and say Iago is only a relic of the Middle Ages. There are modern explanations, too. If the medievals had their concepts and schemes and allegories, so do we also in the 20th century. And the chief inventor of patterns and concepts that describe and explain human behavior in the 20th century are the psychologists. Modern specialists see men in a psychic pattern, caught in the toils of the unconscious. In particular, several psychoanalysts have produced brilliant readings of Iago as motivated by unconscious, repressed homosexuality. This argument goes as follows. He is in love with Othello and in love with Cassio, or at least attracted to them both. They are both highly attractive men. But he cannot permit himself to recognize this fact. So he proceeds to cope with it by a variety of unconscious strategies. Now, so far, there certainly seems to be something to this. He's fascinated with both Cassio and Othello. He pays them much more attention than he pays his own wife. The strategy is to destroy the objects of his love. They pose a threat to him. If he ever has to face what he really feels about them, that will be that will ruin him. He's terribly resentful of them, so he wants to ruin them first. That is, he's going to displace or reject his love for them by foisting it on Desdemona, saying, "I don't desire Cassio, I don't desire Othello, she does. Therefore, let us punish them all for being involved in these wicked desires." There is much to this. You can find support in the lines of the play. I quoted a moment ago the line saying, "There is a daily beauty in Cassio's life that makes me ugly." That's a point where his admiration of Cassio seems to surface in the spoken script and not just be subtext. There's something even more revealing when he's tempting Othello into believing that Cassio has slept with Desdemona. He invents a dream that he reports Cassio as having had. He and Cassio spent the night together, shared quarters one night. And he, Iago, being troubled with a raging tooth, could not sleep. "There are a kind of men so loose of soul that in their sleeps will mutter their affairs. One of this kind is Cassio. In sleep I heard him say, 'Sweet Desdemona, let us be wary, let us hide our loves.'" Okay, Cassio babbled in his sleep about being in love with Desdemona. That's okay, but look where it goes from there. "And then, sir, he would grip and wring my hand and cry, 'Sweet creature,' and then kiss me hard, as if he plucked up kisses by the roots that grew upon my lips, then laid his leg over my thigh and sighed and kissed again and cried, 'Cursed fate that gave thee to the Moor.'" Iago is playing out a fantasy of Cassio making love to him. Now, the whole point, and it's pretty hot fantasy, too. The whole point is to inflame Othello, but it may tell us more about what's really going on in Iago's mind in the lower reaches. That would suggest the relation with Cassio, the desire for Cassio. The desire for Othello is there in the whole temptation of Othello into jealousy of Desdemona. The deception of Othello is played as a very long step-by-step scene in the middle of the play. It is, in fact, a seduction scene as Iago gets closer and closer to the personal affairs of Othello. And it ends with their swearing a vow to each other. Iago kneels on stage and says, "Witness, you ever-burning lights above, you elements that clip us round about, witness that here Iago doth give up the execution of his wit, hands, heart, to wronged Othello's service." And Othello replies, I greet thy love, not with vain thanks, but with acceptance bounteous. Now art thou my lieutenant. And Iago replies, I am your own forever. The two of them are kneeling on stage, swearing this vow of eternal loyalty. It is almost a marriage scene, a wedding scene. It carries that impact. Well, this is a possible modern interpretation of Iago's motivations, and it has been used in modern productions by no less a person than Laurence Olivier. Laurence Olivier had already played a Freudian Hamlet. Then when he went on to play Iago opposite the fellow of Ralph Richardson, he called up Ernest Jones, the disciple of Freud, from whom he got the Freudian ideas about Hamlet, and said, can you give me some Freudian ideas about Iago, too? And what I have just explained is what he got, and Olivier worked that out into the staging. Richardson, playing Othello, didn't really understand what he was doing. Richardson didn't go in for this kind of thing at all. And there is a famous moment where, in rehearsal, Olivier kissed Richardson on the mouth, and Richardson said, dear boy, this will never do. And as a matter of fact, the idea did not, in fact, do. This took place in 1937. Freudian ideas were not very widespread in England at that time. The audience didn't understand what was going on. If you read the critics reviewing that production, you will see that they don't understand. They didn't understand. Nonetheless, it's a possible idea, and I have no objection to an actor's preparing a role in this kind of depth psychological way. And I've no real objection to Freudian analysis as a sort of intellectual exercise. There is a problem here that you are working on the play as if it were a case history. You can't actually put Iago on the couch and ask him to free associate and do the sort of Freudian analysis that you would with a live patient. Both the medieval vice theory and the psychoanalytic repressed homosexual theory resort to abstract patterns to find a context for some rather mysterious behavior. I want to put these two ideas together, the medieval idea and the 20th century idea. They really are both abstractions for behavior that we find painful to acknowledge. It is really we who need an explanation for hatred, for Iago's lust to destroy others. I think the Freudian idea is as much an allegory as the medieval idea. Both of them tend to flatten out the tortured humanity of Iago. Promiscuous hatred of the kind exemplified in Iago does exist in human life. It disturbs us deeply. We ache to know why it should exist, to know why might help us deal with the pain. It might perhaps help us know what to do if we encountered a person as consumed with hatred as Iago is. You notice we do this with unpleasant feelings. If there is someone who is bountiful, loving, generous to all mankind, we don't ask what peculiar complex in that person makes him so forthcoming. We do it with evil and disturbing things. Actually, I don't think Shakespeare has to supply us with an explanation. He supplies us with the experience. That's his business as a playwright, to show us what hatred and envy are like. Hatred and envy and destructiveness. He recognizes that we want explanations. He has Othello ask at the end of the play, why has he ensnared my soul and body? Even more, he has Iago ask. He has Iago offer up those six motives that I listed at the beginning, as if he himself were trying to figure out why he is so hateful. I've been saying throughout these lectures on tragedy that Shakespeare does not have an all-encompassing explanation of the meaning of tragedy. Rather, that he allows the characters to probe the meaning of their suffering. It is part of the tragic experience that he writes that the characters themselves are perplexed by it. It is part of the suffering that they go through an effort to find explanations, that they try to account for it to themselves. In this particular case, in the case of Iago, we find a man asking not why he's suffering, but why is he inflicting suffering on other people? I think the hatred is greater than any explanation we can offer for it. Any explanation than Iago can offer for it. A very famous phrase has been applied to it by the early 19th century poet and critic Samuel Taylor Coleridge. Coleridge described Iago's favorite activity as the motive hunting of motiveless malignity. The motive hunting of motiveless malignity. He is malign, it is without a motive, and he himself hunts for the motive. I think that phrase captures something essentially accurate about Iago. The malignity does transcend the motive. Iago desires to do dirt on life. That, by the way, was D.H. Lawrence's phrase for it. To blacken what is true or good or beautiful. Or to use Iago's own phrase, to turn their virtue into pitch. That envy of the daily beauty in Cassio's life that makes him ugly. I think he also envies Othello and Desdemona's beauty. There's a bit in Iago of the homely, chubby, greasy-haired high school boy who isn't popular and who envies the in-crowd, the school leaders, the athletes and the cheerleaders, and who gets back at them by being cleverer than they are, by entrapping them with his wit. He certainly dislikes anything that they have that is beautiful. Therefore, when he describes the imagined sex between Desdemona and Othello, of course he hadn't seen them having sex, he describes it in that terrible way. They're making the beast with two backs. An old black ram is tupping your white ewe. He likes starting brawls. He likes starting fights. He starts a riot in the first scene of the play with Brabantio's servants. He gets Cassio drunk in the second act, and that turns into a sword fight. And there's a third brawl in the streets in the last act, which results in Rodrigo's death and the wounding of Cassio. The man is possessed by an irrational hatred. He desires, again in his phrase, to enmesh them all. What's really strongest in the writing of Iago is not the explanations offered, but the verbs describing the activity, to turn virtue into pitch, to enmesh them all. He despises most of the rest of mankind. He despises any man who does not keep his heart strictly attending on himself, any man who fails to be guided by self-interest. And yet it irritates him enormously that in this preposterous world, men and women who do have instincts of generosity and regard for honor and honesty, such as Desdemona, Othello, Cassio, somehow manage to be thought well of, even are successful. They are successful. In Othello's case, they are also powerful and noble and generous and true and imaginative. Iago just can't bear that. He's got his own doctrine of life, which is entirely self-centered. Shakespeare gives him a complete set of beliefs about how human beings should really behave. This comes at the end of the Senate scene. He's talking to Rodrigo alone after everyone else has left the stage, the end of Act 1, Scene 3. And Rodrigo mentions virtue. Iago responds, virtue, a fig. Tis in ourselves that we are thus or thus. Our bodies are our gardens, to the which our wills are gardeners. So that if we will plant nettles or sow lettuce, set hyssop and weed up thyme, why the power and corrigible authority lies in our wills. That is, we can do what we want with ourselves. Make ourselves full of nettles or make ourselves full of lettuce. To go back to quoting him, if the balance of our lives had not one scale of reason to poise against another of sensuality, the blood and baseness of our natures would conduct to most preposterous conclusions. We have reason to cool our raging motions, our carnal stings, our unbitted lusts, whereof I take this that you call love to be a sect or scion. Love is merely a lust of the blood and a permission of the will. We are completely in control. We are gardeners to the gardens of our bodies. Our wills can do what we want. Our wills can control our passions. And love is just a passion, a lust of the blood, seconded by a permission of the will. Now, this is sound Elizabethan psychology. They did believe that the reason should control the passions, that we were given our wills to exert that control, that we were full of lusts left over from the fall of Adam, from our corrupted natural condition, but that the will and the reason should control our desires in this fashion. This doctrine, in other words, that Iago is preaching to Rodrigo, has enough truth in it to be plausible. In fact, a great deal of truth. What's wrong with it is simply what is left out. Iago supposes that the individual human will is all-powerful. He does not admit the existence of any other power, that there might be anything like grace in the world, God's power, God's gift to strengthen us in our overcoming our baser desires, God's mercy, God's forgiveness. He denies implicitly, in this description of our psychology, any spiritual operation, that love is anything more than a lust of the blood and a permission of the will, that love might be a genuine attraction toward another person, finding in that other person something comparable to ourselves, finding in that other person beauty, finding in that other person an image of God. He denies implicitly any sort of imagination that sees beyond ourselves as fleshly creatures. He denies any heroism, any self-sacrifice. He denies all those things that make us more than calculating animals. Iago's viewpoint on human beings is really rather simple. It is also rather brutal, and I mean that literally, animalistic, of the brutes. And finally, rather dull in the way he limits the possibilities of humankind. His effect on other people is malignant. His effect on the audience can be mesmerizing. For a while we follow this man as he exerts his great cleverness, his cynicism, his resourcefulness. We even may be amused by him as he plays tricks on other people, until we realize how empty, narrow, and destructive it is, how much it hurts other people whom we, in fact, like much more. Other people who have possibilities for heroism, love, and self-sacrifice.